So I like to, the talks I gave today are a mixture of right effort, the four right efforts, and I kind of on a mission to introduce Buddhist meditators to right effort. This is the classic traditional definition of the right effort in the Noble Eightfold Path. There's been a lot of talk about mindfulness, some talk about concentration, some talk about right speech, but right effort has been neglected quite often. And so right effort is a very beautiful part of the path. That's the garden simile. The Four Noble Truths, which most of you are familiar with, there is suffering, there is a cause of suffering, there is an end to suffering, there is a way to the end of suffering. That is quite often compared to a medical prescription, a doctor's prescription. So you go to the doctor and he says, yes, you have a disease. The cause of the disease is this, and there is a cure for it. And so this is the course of action which we're going to institute to come to the cure for this illness. So that is frequently the way they talk about the Buddha modeling his prescription of the Four Noble Truths on a kind of the way a medicine would be. And the way the teachings of the Buddha are often borrowed, or he utilizes skillful structures of the mind and also of communication. So right effort is also modeled in its, I prefer the gardening model. So the first is to, when you're gardening, is to look for what you don't want there, and you consider how to remove it, and to prevent its return. That's the first half of right effort. Second half is the positive side. What is in your garden that you want to maintain? What is beautiful? What is useful? What is nourishing? What gives you shade? There's all kinds of benefits to gardens. There's not just vegetable gardens, there's flower gardens, and there's shade gardens, all kinds of gardens. And so all the beautiful qualities which we want in the interior life are types of gardens. And so there are some things you will find, check over in your life, say, you know, I have patience sometimes, or I have goodwill, I have a sense of humor or something. These are all beautiful things which we want to keep and cultivate. And then there are certain things that are not present or in a very nascent form, and that we want to bring in and import. And sometimes, literally, as we see bamboo imported around here and so forth. If you have to import ideas and techniques from outside of your own culture, that's fine. That's what I did. I had to go to the ends of the earth to find exotic plants. They're very beautiful. They grow in this climate. We're not talking about this climate. We're talking about this climate in here. I try, you know, of course, culture. There's elements of culture in what you can understand, what you find useful, and appreciate. Each culture is different, etc. But we have to find positive things that work for us and communicate to us to introduce into this, the garden of self. A garden is good because it's not a fixed thing. It's always moving, changing, growing. There's a relationship between the plants, and sometimes they cooperate, they assist each other. So this is a complex, growing, living, interior state you have, and that is what right effort is. And it's introduced before right mindfulness and right concentration. It's the preparation to tell you where you're going with this. What are you going to do now? And the mindfulness is the tools which you are about to engage to bring this about. So there's another summary of the teachings of the Buddha, one that the monks recite quite often, called the Ovada Patimokkha. This was a talk, a very brief talk given by the Buddha before he established the refined structures of the Sangha. There's a story that a number of enlightened monks collected on the full moon night, and he gave a very brief summary. And one of the most essential summaries is the essence of the Dhamma is to do no evil, to do the good, to purify the mind. This is the teaching of all Buddhas. So notice the structure of that. To do no evil, to give up that which is harmful, painful to others, to oneself, as the actions, that includes speech and actions. To do the good, that's the activity. So we're not merely passive, we're active as well. We are to do the good. To do the good for ourselves and others. And finally, to purify the mind. And there you see, again, a little, very brief summary of right effort. First, not to do the negative. Second, to do the positive. Third, to purify the mind, which is, again, purifying it of the negative states. And what is left? When you purify the mind, what is left, the pure mind, is a positive condition. It's luminous by its nature. That is another famous and very beautiful saying. It's pondered over by scholars and contemplatives since the time of the Buddha. Very brief, occurs a few times. The mind, O monks, is luminous, but is defiled by adventitious defilements. Adventitious is just things which rise and flow through, negative things. Its essential nature is luminous. The mind, O monks, is luminous, but is not defiled by adventitious defilements. So it's possible to free the mind from this tendency of clouds to pass through it. Its nature is the blue sky, like the blue sky, but in ordinary structures, physical elements in the blue sky and in the psychological dimension impede the luminosity of the mind. The mind in its nature is luminous, and that's so the purifying of the mind leaves you with this blue dome of the sky, this mind that is light, free of these psychic irritants and the impediments to your freedom. So this is why right effort is so important to understand, and that we need to use as many tools as we have in our box of skills to rid ourselves of these negative things. And we're not merely Stoic philosophers seeing how things are. We need to understand how things are, and then to introduce drastic changes. Some of these changes occur very fast, some of them occur gradually. Some people progress quickly, some people more slowly. Some people it's pleasant, slow but pleasant. Some people difficult. So sometimes some aspects of practice for you might be difficult, but you can get over it quick. Others, very, very pleasant. And so there's time and there's the quality of the experience. And there's at least four possibilities in there for how to experience this. But it's not like we need to make it painful or slow. There's no great virtue in that. We can see through history that there's a tendency in humans to find virtue in really making it hard on themselves. And the Buddha, I suppose, as an example, we're presuming that in a way, that he did undertake some very severe and difficult practices and gave them up and said, that is what I just did there is ignoble, is painful, and is not wise. Don't do that. So we have to take a note from that, that it's the middle path. It's very beautiful, and the image of sitting on the bank of the river with a cool breeze under the shade of the tree, out of the sun. So some of his practices were at night when it was cold. He slept out in the open. In the day when it's really hot, he sat out in the open. He ignored the shade. So he decided, no, that's not the way. In the day when it's hot, sit in the shade. In the night when it's cold, take shelter. And so this is a very kindly advice. Who knows the way cultures can form themselves? There's all kinds of famous cultures in history. The famous in Greece, there's Athens and Sparta. The Spartans are famous for their extreme austerities and harsh discipline, and the belief that that was the way to triumph. And Athens is a more moderate, open, more liberal kind of culture, and eventually they go to war, and Athens wins. A more humane type of realization that, and it just becomes a habit pattern. And of course, different families, different characters, start to embody this kind of that life is hard, should be hard. We have to undo that, but at the same time, we're wise enough to say that it's not just a series of indulgences. That becomes shallow, frivolous, and unsatisfactory as well. So that's the nature of right effort. And that the profound emphasis the Buddha places on emotions. You don't have a choice. You're going to have some emotion. It's not like you can avoid that. If you're under the impression, say, that in pure vipassana practice, that the emotions are ignored somehow, that you just are interested in the rising and passing without judgment of whatever rises and passes, that is not really the case. In emotion, from a Buddhist definition, emotion is, there is a factor of choice in it. Emotions are not simply resultants, but there's an element of choice. You're choosing, and you can choose to diminish, sustain, or increase emotions. You may not be skillful at it. You may not. It may be a little clumsy and everything, but whatever you're left with is a type of emotion. You can't exist without something. So the Buddha is saying, I'm not saying that all emotions are just, they're just all impermanent, so it doesn't matter. In fact, when we're in negative emotions, our mindfulness is impaired. We are not properly mindful. And that is revealed in the fact that, so for instance, the emotion of anger is a distorted emotion, which lingers unwisely on the attention to the fault in a person, in yourself, in the world around you, unwisely attends to that and perceives that as an enduring aspect. That is why you're angry, aversive. So therefore you've lost your mindfulness. Your mindfulness is to tell you the truth about the nature of reality, that it has these characteristics of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and insubstantiality. If your mindfulness was truly reporting that to you, what do you think you would feel? Would you feel disappointed, angry? No. In fact, and that's a good question. Lots of people say, well, if I see it all that way, don't I lose, what do I do? Don't I lose motivation, etc.? No. In fact, if it's perceived correctly, As it is, of course, when we say intellectually, everything is changing. Is that true? Yes. It's easy to get people to agree to that. If everything is changing, it's not really substantial. And if you are dependent on a certain condition and it changes on you, that you'll find that unsatisfactory, won't you? So it's fairly easy to get people to agree to that. But what will happen if you really see that and internalize that, and that's your base operating mode, if that's the way that your consciousness is completely in tune with the fact that every situation is just passing, right? The Buddha says, if you really saw it that way, you would have a range of emotions that would be what we would call wholesome and positive. In fact, they would be called the factors of enlightenment. They would range from joy to equanimity. They could and include any of these divine emotions of love, of compassion, of sympathetic joy, of profound equanimity. They can include those positive things. Those are not only contradictory to the vision of things as impermanent, insubstantial, unsatisfactory. They are intrinsically an aspect of this positive emotional response. So you will be left with a very positive, very beautiful interior state if you see things this way. So that this idea of vipassana, of seeing, and sometimes the idea of vipassana and mindfulness is sometimes confused. These are two different words. Sati is mindfulness. It's the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path. Vipassana is a resultant. Is if you are mindful, clear, attain concentration, quite naturally, quite possibly out of this combination of wisdom, mindfulness, and samadhi, what will result? You will see clearly. And that's what vipassana means. You will see clearly. So vipassana is more or less a result rather than a process. It's a result. A result of a process. Lucid clarity. It is accompanied by serenity. Samatha and vipassana are partners. They arrive at the kingdom of consciousness to inform, correctly give appropriate and accurate information about the nature of the world to your consciousness. Only through serenity and clear seeing do you see the world as it truly is, as a dream, as a bubble, as dew on the grass in the morning. It's transient like that, flows like that. That's how it really is. If you see that, will you be disappointed? Will you be upset? No. You'll be lucid, wise, and emotionally in a steady state of well-being. So that's how it all works together. So I say this because quite often there's a forgetting, sorry about this, the robes. There is a easy to forget, and in teaching vipassana, in teaching things, there's quite often a great emphasis on technique and what is about to happen here, and a certain accompanying message that this could be a difficult experience, and it's not necessarily going to be fun, but now if it's necessary to balance those type of messages with the fact that the Buddha is saying that there might be some difficulties on the way, but we really are going to something is transcendently, powerfully beautiful in the human experience. And it's not something that's mystical and a preoccupation with odd phenomena in reality. It is a very direct and important, not just important, the important. The meaning of life is in the is felt, right? And this feeling, it makes you fully and wisely a human being. And is not, you cannot misidentify it. It will tell you. Your whole system will register to this. So that is the in brief, what it is that one should be doing in their one's meditation and the vision and the recollection of these things. The teachings of the Buddha are a very large canon of things. Again, he summarizes it sometimes. He gives you slightly extended versions of it, more detailed versions of it. He gives you moderately long versions of it. And then he gives you very long versions that have all of the details and the entire chemistry table is in there. If you want to do your PhD in chemistry or physics, and some people like that. Some people are inclined that way. So for those like that, those eggheads are, they got the whole Abhidhamma, they can 6,000 pages of candy for intellects. And then there's other people that just in a handful, just in a verse, the Buddha just gives them a verse. They're just simple people, and he just says, this very four lines, he says, this is how it is. They get it like that. It's good. So, find teachings that do it for you. You know, find things that speak to you. Know your nature. That's all that matters. These are just messages, and all that we care about is results. Indeed, remember that you do not need to know the entire teachings of the Buddha, or just good, useful parts. And in fact, sometimes it's contraindicated to, it just impedes you to endlessly study all of this stuff instead of taking some of it and using it and becoming, moving across this river, which keeps you on the dangerous side of life. You want to cross over that river. So the famous parable is the parable of the raft. The flood comes on one side of the river. The other side of the river is high ground. You better cross over the river, but you can't swim, so you need a raft. And I in my early days, I heard the raft parable many times, and I envisioned a very nice raft, a very large raft, you know, like Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn. When I read the actual words, I realized it's a very primitive raft. It's not even a raft. It's a bundle of sticks. That it keeps the guy's chest above, like he puts his chest on the bundle of sticks. Half of his body is in the water, and then he kicks with both feet and he paddles with both hands. That is the so-called raft. I think raft is a bad translation of that. That is maybe a life jacket. So he put on your life jacket and head for the other shore with both hands and both feet. Now, both feet and hands are the four right efforts. The effort to prevent, the effort to remove, the effort to sustain, and the effort to cultivate. To prevent the negative stuff and to encourage the positive stuff. This is what it is. So you're in just basically a life jacket. It's not an elaborate, it's not a spaceship, it's a bundle of sticks. What are the sticks? The bundle of little teachings like you get at a weekend retreat. This is the bundle of sticks. Or the, whatever they fill life jackets with. I'm just, I'm giving out life jackets here. You did notice the name of this is the Church of the Titanic. So it is going down, you know. Look over the edge. No, don't fight over the deck chairs, because it just doesn't matter. Or even what deck you're on. Just make sure you got that life jacket, bundle of sticks, and then you got to swim like heck and to get to that other side. Now I'm mixing up my metaphors. I got the Titanic in a river sinking. There's bundles of life jackets and stuff. But I think you get the idea. Now, so that's enough for me today for this kind of closing talk. But I would like to entertain any questions if you have them. And I do. I have any off the top of your head. I do have a yes.